Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Saxon Jacks. A little late. Time out. Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 4. NASDAQ futures up 9. Evidently, the Uber's kind of messed up with the continuing cold weather here in Chicago, but here we are. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah. Gee, Tom, I hate to think of you as the late Tom Howe.
Yeah. Well, one of these days we'll have to, right?
Soon enough. Don't rush it.
No, let's not rush that. As usual, we got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about, but I wanted to hit on you guys, you and our Notre Dame pals, a lot of texts going back and forth this weekend about Notre Dame's commitment to, well, we'll see, but what may be a ridiculously old model, and our infatuation with it maybe is just that, an old guy's infatuation. I was reading yesterday a little bit about some of these high school kids getting NIL deals. To big money. I mean, real big money. And I just was trying to figure out, maybe we could discuss, how the hell does that even happen? I mean, who's signing it, and what are they signing people up for? What are they getting for it? Part of it, I guess, is some of these kids appear to have websites, and they're sponsoring the websites because they get a bunch of hits, evidently. Now, just the thought of me spending my time going to a website from a guy who plays tackle at the high school down the road would never even occur to me at that age. But obviously, things have changed, and people's how they spend their time and all that kind of stuff. But it seems like any sort of attempt, to try and pin, today's, our sort of logic on what's going on today. I think the whole bets are off, and I think everybody who is involved really needs to take a look and take a breath and say, where the hell are we going with this? Because I'm not so sure we're not going straight by the European model. And
that isn't necessarily bad.
No, but I mean, what if
per se the European model might be more honest and more upfront than what we have now. But my question about high school kids getting NIL money is, how can they execute a contract if you're not of legal age?
No, you're not supposed to do that. I was supposed to ask you that.
Contract. How do you do it? The parents sign them up? What happens there? Who signs off on that?
Well, what just happened here? I was going to ask you that. Yeah, well, what is that, my friend? What are you buying, I guess is the question, whatever. But if we go out for coffee this morning, we're buying coffee. What exactly are you buying? I guess if you could buy sponsorship to somebody's podcast or web thing or something, that I sort of get, don't you? I mean, at that level, I think I get it. If somebody really has a massive podcast because he's a basketball player, or I think a lot of them seem to be young ladies that are already doing like modeling and stuff. Well, that I can understand.
Kids have been doing modeling forever.
Yeah, I mean,
I get that.
But just let's kind of review just a hair, as much as I know about it. Where's Mike when we need him? Maybe if he's around, I hope he'll chime in. What I understand, the European model is the professional teams identify people younger, and they will sign them up early. You know, just like if you see a kid as a terrific gymnast when he's 8 years old, I mean, you somehow you're trying to get the guy in some gym classes and something. But they basically totally skirt the colleges. And if you're going to play soccer, you're not going to play for University of Nuremberg. You're going to play for whatever team that is. If you happen to go to the University of Nuremberg, it's on you, pretty much. I assume that they have some sort of a club system, where Nuremberg probably does have guys playing soccer, and then they'll play some other university down the road, much like things used to be here 100 years ago. I don't know that, but I suspect that's the way it was, because we had club teams at Notre Dame. And if people wanted to play, they found a way to play, right, and found people to play against. But if we're going to run with the model, and this is, I guess, you know, this is what I kind of believe, Kevin, is that some people are going to go to college and play sports for as many years as they feel like. Pretty soon, I mean, we're going to be up to five here in a minute, seemingly a couple of months. I don't think six is far behind. If four years and 2 years of graduate school is a college. So if we're up to six, I could see somebody going, I'm gonna make money playing at, you know, some place. I'm gonna get my law degree and I'm gonna go out and be a lawyer after 6 years and never even be a total. It would be a total competitor to the system we have now, where allegedly to make money you had to go play for the Bears. Now, why do I have to do that? I'm gonna make money for 6 years and then I'm gonna be a lawyer and I'm fine, or a doctor, or whatever the hell I'm gonna do afterward. Maybe I'm not as good. Is the guy who's going to make his money in the pros, but you know what? Maybe I am, and I just want to be a lawyer. Or I want to play 6 years. I could see that.
That would be like Ken McAfee quitting his professional football career early to become a dentist.
Yeah, and so if that's the case, what's going to stop the Bears and these other guys that now have this old clunky collective bargaining system, which may turn out to be a big weakness on their part? What would stop the Bears from saying, I'm going to sign the kid in high school and, you know, screw this draft crap. I'm going to sign the kid in high school, much like they used to be able to do with guys out of Haiti and Cuba and Dominican Republic, right? I'm going to sign this kid in high school. He's going to go to my camp. I can see it happen in basketball quicker because you get better quicker. And all of a sudden, he's never going to college. Screw them. Where we actually are full competitors, where they're both essentially pro leagues, where people get picked off young, they start paying, and the parents just sign the kid up for the Chicago Bears, for God's sake. I mean, why, once we open the door to this, why isn't any of this more possible than the current mess they have now?
Well, there's all kinds of possibilities, and I don't see anything wrong with that. It might totally change the nature of how things are done, but don't industries do that all the time?
Yeah, well, I mean, we thought, you know, that there was some honor and glory for playing for our Lady of Notre Dame. When in fact, obviously, the last few years, maybe there are a few people still feel that way, but I sure don't think the amount of people flying back in portals. Actually, I heard last night that Marquette is the only major college team that doesn't have anybody through the portal, or hasn't had anybody through the portal.
I don't know that that's true, Tom.
Well, they either haven't had somebody leave through the portal or haven't everybody come in through the portal. Because I was watching the game last night, and the announcer was very, very adept, and he was very clear about it. But one or the other, they haven't had a portal either escape or pickup. I forgot which one it was.
I'll check it out.
But I mean, whatever it is, there's teams that are in it to various degrees, so you'll agree with that at least. Some teams just want everybody through there, right?
Patino just did an interview where he said, they have so many people leave that they really can't afford to bother with high school. So he's one of the few that's saying, I'm pretty much just going to work the portal every year. I think that takes a really different kind of coaching skill to be able to coach an all-new team every year and have no continuity. But I suppose, you know, it sort of gets into the, I ain't breaking the rules, I'm just taking advantage of them mindset.
Well, what? Why would everybody leave every year? I mean, they couldn't wait to get away from him or something.
Well, it could be, but Patino's he's been a slime ball at various times in his career, but he's a really good coach.
Well, I get that. I'm saying
you know, after doing his penance, after being ousted at Louisville, he did his penance at Iona, and now he's at St. John's, and they're very good.
Well, what do you suppose?
Everywhere he's been.
If we were going to do the full cost update, since I don't really know that much how that would work, what do you suppose the cost is of, I use the term, snatching somebody through the portal, or calling up somebody else, and I'll use the term pilfering somebody from another team, because I have a feeling there's a lot of that going on, where you just call somebody and say, hey, I see your sixth man on the bench there, looks to me like you could be in our rotation here, but by the way, we'll pay and those guys aren't. I mean, what is the cost of that versus flying, watching some guy in his high school games, if they do that anymore, or watching tape, or going out to meet the parents and all the other crap that goes with it? Which one's cheaper, you think?
Transfers for sure.
You know, maybe he doesn't want to get on a plane and go visit people's parents anymore. I wouldn't.
Well, yeah, but and yeah, I can see that too. You know, that would make sense. But in the case of recruiting transfers, you know, you bring them in for a visit, and so on. But when they're recruiting high school kids, they're, you know, the coaches are on the road all the time. They're going to all these tournaments and such. There's a significant time and expense to it.
I would say that as much as the rumor is that he'd become a little bitter in life. I don't know if that's true or not. Digger Phelps, in his 20-year stint at Notre Dame, I think you could make the argument that the last 4 or 5 years where the teams weren't as good sort of related to his seemingly further disgust with getting on the recruiting thing and hustling around like he did when he was younger. Do you think that's...
It also related to the fact that they weren't in a conference when it was a really bad thing to not be in a conference those last few years. There were a lot of independents early in his career, but once the Big East came along in particular, and then you started getting the Atlantic 10 and all these other different conferences, there were no games to schedule. They played a crap schedule. They really had nothing going for the program, and until they joined the Big East, which they did when John McLeod was the coach, and then went in and got their brains beaten in for a few years before they hired Mike Bray and started doing well in the Big East. It was damn near impossible to win in that situation. If you go back and look at some of their schedules, all the conferences were playing on the weekends now, and they weren't going to go. They weren't going to go play Notre Dame. So you know, it was kind of the Wednesday, Saturday, or Thursday, Sunday schedule, and he wasn't getting, he wasn't able to get games like he did. You know, then that's how Phelps built up the program during his early years, is he scheduled all these marquee games, and he was always on television, which was really big for recruiting. By the end, he was recruiting against Butler when it was a really low-level school, Valparaiso, you know, the very low-level, programs at the time.
When was his last... His last big recruits wasn't his last year, but it was
probably the last major one that he got was LaFonso Ellis,
and he was a solid ball player, obviously, for a long time.
He was a great ball player. Yeah. He was a terrific college player, and he had a really nice pro career too.
Who was the guy? I'm trying to remember the name. I think he passed away young. I thought when they had the Big O, Orlando Woolridge.
Mm-hmm.
When Michael Jordan first came up, and before the NBA changed their rules where you had to play man-to-man, so teams would go with the 2-on-2. Remember that? The 2-on-2 isolated offense. Remember that?
Yeah.
For those that don't know what I'm talking about, if you had two really incredible guys, what you would do is you'd take your three other guys and you'd move them to the right or left side of the lane where the defense had to follow them, because he couldn't play zone. So the other two guys basically played a 2-on-2 game. I don't think there's ever been, I don't think there's ever been two people that were better at it than Orlando Woolridge and Michael Jordan. Because if Big O could get to the basket almost as good as Michael, those guys were unreal. And then for some reason they traded Big O. And it was why they traded him, I have no idea, but he ended up finishing his career somewhere else.
It was all culture stuff. The Let's just say the Bulls, when Jordan arrived, he had some pretty good partiers as teammates.
Yeah. Who was the guy who was the other guard? He was Mr. Party. What the hell was his name? You know what I'm talking about?
No.
he was their star for a while, and then he kind of faded due to drugs, I think.
Oh, like a Reggie Theus, maybe?
No, it wasn't him. It was shorter than Theus. Reggie Theus is a hell of a player.
He was a hell of a player. Reggie Theus also had one of the great lines, because he played at UNLV, and the Bulls at the time had Ricky Sobers from UNLV played with him, and they had Sudden Sam Smith, and it was Reggie Theus who said, "One more guy from UNLV and the NBA is going to have to put us on probation."
God. Well, and I just mean this: how this shakes out, Kevin. It's somewhat of a question of morals. It's somewhat of a question of, I mean, at some point, if ever, are people going to start, stop dying for state, like on TV, when state is just another pro team? I mean, some schools are hanging in there, and I don't know. Well, to get back to the original thing, what exactly are you buying in a high school kid? What are you buying a pro kid? I mean, a college kid, or are you buying the ability to send him to the school?
I just don't understand the world of influencers.
Well, I mean, let's say, for instance, the kid's 17. Now, does his dad have to sign the contract for advertising on his podcast? I guess he probably does, doesn't he?
I would think so, and, if you have a podcast, it would be interesting to see the ownership structures on some of these. I'm sure a lot of it is just handled real loosely, and ultimately some of those contracts are going to be, the modern-day version of the Columbia Record Club.
Yeah, well, and so...
Any deal is completely unenforceable because you have a minor who is not legally... considered legally able to sign a contract.
Or are they playing... They're not playing any more football games, I doubt, but are they playing basketball games outside of the high school, sort of like an AAU model, and they're paying them to show up for those games?
No, it's not... it's not like soccer or even softball, where a lot of people do play clubs during the season instead of playing at their high schools. As far as I know, there isn't anything significant being played in basketball outside of the high schools. Doesn't mean there never will be, though.
Well, I mean, the high school, these kids are, the day after the high school season ends, they're playing someplace. You're saying it's just the playground? I don't know about
Brian. Yeah, but they don't interfere with the high school schedule. Whereas if you're looking at soccer, the best players are out playing clubs and traveling teams, and they do not play for their. They do not play for their high schools.
Okay, so if
they're playing, the seasons are the same.
I guess the question is, it would seem like, since you have crossovers, I'll be nice, between places that sponsor the universities and places that sponsor the kids, you would think that if PTI Securities went out and sponsored Andrew's kid when we were a huge sponsor of Notre Dame, we had, I don't know if they have programs anymore, if we had two pages in the program and all this stuff, we went and sponsored Andrew's kid, I'm going to say it would be unlikely that he would go to Alabama with us still paying him, unless we also sponsored Alabama, which isn't to accuse anybody of, you're essentially buying the kid for Notre Dame or Alabama or whoever else you happen to be sponsoring. I mean, there's obviously some influence. You're buying something. I guess what I'm trying to figure out, what were you, are you buying, can the old man, if he signs the contract, sign away the kid's right to choose his own school?
Or I would say that would be a pretty difficult court case to make.
But the same token, if you are, I'll pick the term, won't be Bud Light, but say it's Red Bull, you show up in the living room and say, "Look, I'm going to give you a big Red Bull contract, and by the way, we also sponsor, Saugatuck Valley, and we expect you to go to Saugatuck Valley." Okay, it looks like a nice place to me. And 4 months later, you go, "I'm not going to Saugatuck Valley, I'm going to Slippery Rock." And you say, "Well, we had a deal." "Well, no, you and Dad had a deal." Or, I think,
Once the kid turns 18, they didn't have a deal with him. He turns 18, he says, I'm going to Slippery Rock because that's where my girlfriend's going.
Well, the way to stop that, I guess, is say, okay, you're getting some of this money now, but until you do turn 18 and you put your name on it, I'm not giving you the rest. Why wouldn't I do that if I'm Red Bull?
Doesn't that sound like a sound business deal?
Yeah, I mean, you're getting a little bit. You go out and buy a car at 17. You can't even buy a car at 17, right?
A lot of the people involved in this are not stupid, especially on the business side, the people who believe they're getting some value out of this. And really, most of it is social media, podcasts, and things like that. And I don't doubt it. I don't know that area of marketing. I don't know it well, so I'm not going to vouch for it 100%, but I'm assuming that there is some value to getting somebody who has a following and having your products involved. No different than any other celebrity endorsement, just on a different scale in a different medium.
Well, if you have one guy or lady, if you have one person like Michael Jordan, Nike was going to donate pretty much a whole line of shoes to him for a long time. They weren't going to have, Oscar Robertson shoes sitting next to him, next to his on the shelf, I don't think. And same thing with Tiger Woods. I mean, there was a full...
Yeah, no, there were others besides Johnson, or excuse me, besides Jordan's.
But I'm saying every high school kid, you could put his name on a shoe in some place. I'm not going to know who the hell he is. I mean, there comes a limit there. I mean, how many different name shoes does Nike want on the shelf? It can't be 100.
Yeah, because at some point you're diluting.
Yeah, and I think you dilute pretty quick.
If you don't want to face a cannibal, but if you must, you would prefer that it be yourself in the mirror.
Yeah, I guess. But, I mean, I can see where in women's basketball, maybe a Caitlin Clark shoe is a winner. I don't know. You can follow it up with a Hidalgo and the three other stars this year. And now you got six of them on the shelf. Unless you say, who do you want on there? And the guy in the store glues the name to the shoe. That'd be an interesting way to do it.
But I think they have Asia Wilson too. Nike's got Asia Wilson, and she's got shoes.
I mean, Tiger Woods had a full line of clothing at Nike too, right? In addition to shoes and all the other stuff and clubs that maybe other people didn't like. He put them golf balls on the map too, right? Pretty much, they didn't have golf balls before him, I don't think. I mean, I'm very curious. Well, the immortal words of Chuck Henry, who was the president of the CBOE, used to say, "I know I'm spending wasting half the money I spend on marketing. I just don't know which half." Maybe it's always been a fascination of mine, Kevin. Is the when I was chairman of the marketing committee for 3 years, 4 years. I learned a lot, but I still, what a lot of people don't quite get, and by the way, I don't really quite get it either, but there's a massive difference between marketing and PR, even though people think it's sort of combined. It's sort of not. Marketing drives towards kind of a result, where if Pepsi does the 15 commercials at the Super Bowl like they used to, they could chart the result over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks of Pepsi sales versus Coke. In most years, I think they at least broke even. Sometimes made money on the deal, because then it would go back to kind of the original or the traditional relationship. But if you are United Airlines and you're flying over, quote, the United Center, nobody's going to take a trip because of that. But it's PR. It's having the name in your head that when you kick up your airfares, maybe you don't even know it, almost subliminal, you'll pick United versus American because the name's in your head and American isn't, or you saw it driving by or something. It's how many touches people have. And I could never figure out if you went to, I was thinking about this when I was younger, with Hohokam Park down watching the Cubs. They must have had 50 Coke signs in there. And I'm thinking, obviously, if you're selling Coke in here, you want a presence. You want people to, when they walk up to the counter, you already got the Coke dancing in their head, like in the drive-in movies used to be, right? The question is, if I put in, what's the marginal value of the 51st sign? If it costs me $1,000 to put the 51st sign in, how many more Cokes do I get out of that sign? Or the 50th sign, or the 49th, or the 48th? I always had fascination with that. Does anybody know? So, I mean, I don't know how much this helps.
A lot of it is measurable in real time. So this is the whole field of analytics and what are you getting out of it. But, you know, I can tell you that that you will immediately see web traffic. So how many times you see a commercial and they give you the website, you know, name? And I did this, and this was more PR than advertising, but I sat and watched real time when I was at Better World Books, watched the web traffic when one of our founders did about a 5 to 7 minute interview on Bloomberg TV. And you know, immediately you see the spike up in web traffic. Now, whether that turned into sales, you know, that's a different measurable. So you can see, okay, how many people got in there? How many people got in there to look out of curiosity, and how many people got in there, which would downstream could turn into sales, and it's really hard to track that. And how many people got in there and said, oh, well, hey, this is interesting. While I'm here, let me buy two books. So, you know, and those you can tell, and, you know, it's immediate. And it spiked up for about 30 to 40 minutes, and then it went back to normal. And then when they replayed the interview over the course of the day, it wasn't as big a spike as the live interview, but there were still big spikes as they played it throughout the day. It was real interesting to watch. And so there's a lot of this stuff nowadays that you can just measure in real time. Whether that's the 50th sign in the baseball stadium, I don't know. But if it's something on the Jumbotron, on the video board at the baseball stadium, you can see if there's a spike there, and that's very measurable.
Well, I mean, I certainly would agree with you on some stuff. Other stuff, like would you say, I just watched the Notre Dame girls basketball team was on some, was that State Farm? They were on something, just a fleeting glimpse in some commercial I saw last night watching the Marquette game of all things. But
the other State Farm commercial?
I think it might have been a State Farm commercial.
Yeah.
But now how are we going to say that, you know, 50, doesn't have to be Hispanic, 50 people, Hispanic names, ladies, are going to see Hannah Hidalgo on there and they're immediately going to call up State Farm guy and canceler Allstate Insurance. I mean, do we really think that's going to happen? Or when it comes time to get insurance and somebody's 16 and they're going to start driving in a year, they'll call State Farm first because Hidalgo was on it. I mean, I'm saying they're doing it for a reason. I just wonder how you... I'll give you an example, Kevin, how you never really know. We used to do, when we say we, my brother used to do a lot of seminars down in Mexico years ago when they were doing peso contracts up here. And, you know, they came up for some seminars, and a lot of people from there came up. And but then all of a sudden the peso contract kind of phased out at the Merck and that kind of thing. And we haven't heard anybody in a long time. All of a sudden, a couple months ago, somebody calls up and says, hey, you guys, like, still around? Well, yeah, we haven't gone anywhere. Hey, how about if I open, like, a big account? Okay. We haven't heard from the guy in a decade. So we got a nice new account from Mexico. I'm like, some of the stuff, you're not going to go buy a car tomorrow. I mean, I doubt very seriously. I saw much of it. I think Hannah Hidalgo is spectacular. But, I mean, if she's out there pumping Ford, I'm not going to put a for sale sign up in my Chevy or buy a Ford pickup. I mean, some of this stuff is...
Yeah, it's positive association.
Yeah, some kind of positive association. But yeah, how do you value it?
Very attractive. She's really good basketball player. So as you know, so it's your basic celebrity endorsement. I don't think Dennis Haysbert is convincing you to close your State Farm insurance account and go buy Allstate either. But as a spokesman for Allstate, he's probably better than most people. So that again, as it's time to shop for insurance, that you're probably more willing to consider Allstate at that point.
Is he the Mayhem guy? He's not the Mayhem guy.
No, Dennis Haysbert from the unit. He was the colonel in there, but his most famous and best role ever was Pedro Serrano in Major League.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
But you know him because of the deep voice and
bats.
And all
that. Bats love warmth. Bats need to be warm. They need to be warm or something. He stole the guy's head cover.
Yeah.
Bats need warmth. Hey.
Bats need warmth. And he did kind of, you know, always looking for Joe Boo to come and teach him how to hit the curb. And finally, at the end, he said, bleep you, Joe Boo.
Oh, yeah. And he had the flame going in his locker. God. But yeah, I mean, you see this kind of happening. In the last few years, I mean, we've been talking about it on the show, how these insurance companies appear to be, you know, sort of in trouble. And the auto insurance piece, I mean, how many billion dollars did State Farm and Allstate and these guys say they lost in auto insurance? And yet, boy, if you took the auto insurance away from TV, I'm not so sure you'd have any shows left. I mean, they're all over the place selling auto insurance. So it's, I mean, you got to wonder if they're losing money in every car they have, why you need want to double the amount of cars. But it seems like that's the, you get all these things sweeping by you, Kevin, and it's hard to understand what the hell's going on sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and again, I'm assuming that for the most part, you know, I mean, and I don't want to make this as a blanket statement because there's a lot of things that you see businesses do that are really, really stupid. But for the most part, they're trying to spend their money in a rational and effective way. So, you know, if you really want to study it, it's going to be... it's going to be the a deep dive into marketing, and that's, you know, marketing doesn't really count as my area of expertise, that's for sure.
Well, what is the, as I get back to it, and I know, you know, we can speculate a little bit, whenever, how can I start this out, my one side of my family was Italian, right, and my grandfather, who was very independent, told the boys, since the neighborhood had unsavory creatures in it, you're walking down the street with guys, you're going to school with guys that are going to be in the Black Hand or the Mafia or something, okay to be friends, don't ever take a dime because then they own you. And I don't think any of my uncles ever did, even though they knew all these guys, or at least a couple of them did. The question is, what exactly do these guys think they're buying? Same question I started us out with. And what is the person who signs the contract for his kid think they're selling? And if you go to Notre Dame and they're paying you a bunch of money and you're sitting on the bench and they're not getting you on the TV at all, do they have influence over the coach because you deliver them the player? I questioned why the Notre Dame quarterback this year wasn't sat down a couple times, and he wasn't. And I don't know if there's some influence there, I just wonder. As I walk along, I wonder. Remember the song? And after you all of a sudden not getting in favor with that particular coach, maybe you're Joe Montana and you're having sex with the coach's daughter or something. Who knows? Does that person say, we now have you a deal with another, you know, ex-shoe school that's not Notre Dame. By the way, you're going to Indiana and you're going to start down there. Now, do you say no? Do you say yes? Can they move you? Are you essentially working for them? I haven't heard any of these questions kind of answered anywhere, Kevin, and I don't know if there aren't is an answer, but every time there's money involved, I wonder who's controlling who.
Well, yeah, I do think there are a lot of coaches, though, being the control freaks that they can be, who would say, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Well, but they wanted the person to make a question. They must. There's a reason why, if you and I have control of Andrew and he's a super athlete, probably the coach of Notre Dame or Indiana or whoever is going to have to talk to us, including him. Why wouldn't they? So, and we may say, okay, we're bringing Andrew to Notre Dame. We're gonna be a sponsor to him at Notre Dame, so you guys don't have to worry about it. Or, you know, you can give him the rest of the pizzas like the rest of the offensive linemen, but we think Andrew's going to be a future all-pro left tackle or something. And all of a sudden, there he is, and he's not playing for a year or two. And you're going to say, hey, coach, we brought him here because we want his name out there, not because now you got somebody else playing. And by the way, we don't think he's as good as Andrew. This could unravel very rapidly, I think. I just wanted.
I know a case where it did.
Okay.
But it had. But we're talking about before the NIL stuff. The son of the CEO of a very, very large company in Memphis was the starting quarterback for University of Memphis, and he had no business in that spot. And this was, you know, when the team was like 2-10, and they continued to allow him to be the starting quarterback because his father was basically donating, you know, a lot of money, more than most of these NIL kids get paid every year. And it was a very awkward, awful situation for a season. And again, that was before NIL, but you know, when you got a very poor school like Memphis, which I know individuals that have bigger brokerage accounts than the endowment at Memphis. When you got a school like that, it was really just a terrible. And nobody ever said, you know, you never had anybody outright say he needs to bench that. You know, it's like everybody acknowledged that we were just kind of stuck for the season with this situation.
Russell, is there a and don't just
as I mean, and this was like, you know, a couple of days. My father was still alive because I remember him griping about it. So I saw an early example of that, and you know that you know you can't tell me that. You know, Anfernee Hardaway, who does have his own, you know, has his own shoes and all that kind of stuff, and coaches at Memphis, that you know, that there's not somebody at Nike that he's talking to about the people he's trying to recruit in the transfer portal.
Yeah, it would just seem like natural conversation. I mean, it's
yeah.
Is there a,
same kind of thing happens in the professional leagues?
Yeah, exactly the same. And you ask what do the kids do? Take a look at UNLV this past football season. They have this one rule that if you played what, four games or less, or less than four games or whatever, but if you only play a partial season, you're not giving up a year of eligibility and you can walk away.
Yeah, the kid wasn't getting paid, allegedly.
Yeah, well, I don't remember exactly what the situation was, but like one or two games into the season last year, and UNLV was one of the schools that they thought might get that group of five, or I guess it's group of six now, if you throw the what's left of the Pac-12 in there, but you know, get the non-power spot in the playoffs. That they were one of the teams that popped up as possibly being there because of the kid that I don't even remember the kid's name, but he got upset about. He may have wanted all of his NIL money up front, or I don't. You know, it was something about the terms.
The story was that he signed up. The assistant coach put him in touch with was it a car dealer or something?
Yeah, there was just because there's no organization to it. And they had the situation with some kid at Memphis who basically burst into Hardaway's office just before the season started this year and said, I want all my NIL money up front. And he said, get out of my office. And the kid, I forgot what school he transferred to. He might be at Kansas State or somewhere like that this year. You know, the basketball kids can do that. They can, if they don't, you know, if they don't suit up in the fall, they can transfer and play in the spring. The last 2 years, Memphis has had a kid suit up mid-year that came from somewhere else like that. So
I think the UNLV
You know what? 100 years ago, the most popular sports in America were, you know, boxing and horse racing. And any movie that you see about corruption, you know, 100 years ago has, you know, dudes fixing a boxing match, dudes fixing a horse race, etc., because all of the money that became involved in those sports, and then they went to poop. And that's what's going to happen now with college football. You know, and you can be as excited as you want about you know, the playoff that you put together and the ratings that you got for one game, but you're ruining it for about 120 schools.
Well, Russell, I think the more detail on the UNLV thing was that the assistant coach essentially helped make the deal, right, Kevin? And
yeah,
and he, but he said, yeah. And he denied that. He said it was just an introduction. Then the head coach, who was also sued or something, was in the lawsuit, said he knew nothing about it. So it's exactly what you would expect, right? I know nothing. And then the kid just quit. He said, if I'm not getting paid, I'm not hanging here. And he left, what, after his fourth? Was it the fourth game, Kevin? You can play four?
It was before four, but it was,
He didn't. Yeah, he didn't burn eligibility, but because he had played, he wasn't eligible to play elsewhere this year. They won't let you play on two teams in the same year.
I got a word for you on that. You're gonna have $5 million coming to Memphis's endowment from some dude at the University of Tennessee if they happen to find a diamond in the rough, and they could use that kid for, they could use that kid for their SEC playoff push or whatever it's gonna become.
Hey Kevin, you just mentioned that. Football, I get, because it's all sort of in the same semester or quarter. How long do you think that's going to last in basketball, where it bridges two semesters or two quarters?
I don't know. I do know of a player who transferred out of Notre Dame. He went to Iona, and he petitioned to play in the second semester because he only played a couple of games in the first semester, and he got denied, so the NCAA wouldn't let him.
How long do you think the NCAA is going to be in charge? If they really are,
well, right now they'll probably. I'm assuming they'll keep some measure of control over basketball, if for no other reason than they own the rights to the tournament. They're the bargaining agent for the NCAA tournament, and the contract is with them. So if that's where the money is, that's where the basketball will be. At least until the expiration of that contract, and I don't know when that is.
Well, if a kid played two games, like Russell's saying, and they said, "Oh no, you can't transfer second half," and he takes
that. You can transfer all you want. You just can't.
Okay, but now if he takes that one to court and says why, what do you think the court says? I mean, at this point, every time somebody says the NCAA, I say NCAA who? I mean, I don't know what.
Well, we talked about this before. That who's the collective bargaining agent? For the players, if they wanted to have collective bargaining, who are the sides in that bargaining arrangement? And right now, there isn't anybody that who could you say is there? There's no such thing as the College Football Players Association.
I'm gonna lob one out there, and since we have a professor on the line, I'm gonna say that the college players should never collective bargain. They should keep it a free market and just keep winning court case after court case. And your Major League Players Association, maybe to take a clear look at that, disband their union and say we're in the same boat. And by the way, we're petitioning the Supreme Court to remove their antitrust exemption. I think they all end up in the same spot.
Yeah, they would end up in the same spot. And I think they disbanded the union once as part of the as a bargaining tactic. I don't remember why they came back.
But it takes a lot of balls if you're a cartel, I'll tell you.
But the real cartel is the ownership. But
well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Well, Lou always feels that once there's a collective bargaining agreement, that all's fair in love and war. And Lou and I don't disagree on many things, but hey. When the steelworkers went up against George Pullman, it wasn't exactly an even fight, was it, Russell?
Went against who?
The steelworkers went against George Pullman. It wasn't really an even fight.
Oh no, it was not. And there was a lot. I don't know. It wasn't as easy for individuals to get guns back then.
But I mean, I'm not so sure that. I'm not so sure Major League Baseball, even though they seemed to hoodwink the owners a few times. I don't think that's an even fight when one's an established monopoly. How the hell are you collective bargaining against a monopoly?
You tell them, you tell them you'll sit out and mess with the value of their monopoly. That's all you got. That's really all you got.
How did the monopoly lose, what got them back to work last time there was a strike?
Well, I'm not saying that the players haven't done it. Marvin Miller was a genius.
They were ordered back to work. because they were found to have engaged in unfair labor practices with their bargaining approach, by refusing to bargain, frankly, and just saying, we built up a war chest over the years. We can afford a shutdown for a really long time. The players won't be able to afford it, so we're just not going to talk to them. And so the players sued for because once you have a collective bargaining situation with the union and the ownership group, then they have to bargain in good faith. That's a subjective assessment, but they do have to. And when it was found that the owners were not bargaining in good faith, they were ordered back to work under the old collective bargaining agreement. And then the owners, not liking the old collective bargaining agreement, started negotiating, and they came to before the end of that season, they came to an agreement. So, and do you know who the judge was? The appellate court judge who ordered them back to work.
I don't know. Whose appointee was he?
No, it wasn't. I don't know whose appointee. It was a she. And it was current Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Really?
Yep.
Well,
she was an appellate court judge at the time.
Now, do the people on the right like that decision?
I like it. I think it was a correct decision. I think it was a correct interpretation of the law, correct interpretation of the circumstance, and. So I think it was very properly decided.
Well, when you go up against a monopoly, I don't know if we got on this subject, but it's always kind of interesting for me anyway. How many people that are under major league contracts are actually, I'll say, in the union? But everybody in the minor league is held to these contracts. Do they even think they're in a union? There's no pay there. There's no anything for those guys. How do they get swept along by the Major League Players Association when they're not? Maybe that's a Russell question, but why are they covered by a union when they're not even close?
It's going to be a Russell or a Lou. Somehow whatever association there is for minor leaguers has agreed that that's going to be their bargaining agent. Now, whether that's correct or not, I don't know. Whether they don't have a bargaining agent at all, and so the minor league baseball imposes their rules. I don't know what the situation is with that, but that would be a good Lou question, because he was involved in it. And I don't know, Russell, do you know anything about it?
About the Minor League Baseball Players Association?
Well, if they even have an association, I don't even know that they have one.
They do have an association, but it's They've been around for a couple of years, and it's more of, you know, it's collective bargaining within, you know, for people that are playing within that area, and they ratified a contract like a year and a half ago or so, I believe. So I always felt like the minor league baseball players should just fall under the major league baseball players, that all of that should be one giant agreement, because the minor league players are being paid by the major league teams anyway.
But the idea that they have no freedom of movement,
uh-huh.
That they get drafted, and most of them are there just to make out the nine players for the guy they really want. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's a horrible place to be for your career in minor leagues.
Yeah, freedom of movement. That's not as attractive as it sounds, because that works both ways.
Well, I mean, there are people
that. Totally works both ways.
Well, but what I'm saying is there are people. I mean, the Cubs, for instance, it looks like they're set for outfielders for 8 years. Why the hell, if you're an outfielder, why would you want to be in the Cubs organization on an A level? I mean, why should the Cubs be at me? I guess
You want to know another terrible team to be in the minors with? There's the Yankees.
Oh yeah, there's gonna be, yeah, probably.
I'll bet you there are high school kids that are all excited when they get drafted by the Yankees until they find out that it's damn near impossible to work your way up within the minor league system to play for the Yankees.
Well, it depends. I mean,
they use the minor league system. They use it to trade for other people.
Well, that's your hope, I guess.
They just buy whatever free agent they want.
They do, and then they'll trade away a bunch of prospects as well in some of those packages, and that's really what they're trying to do, is they're trying to develop someone that, or they're trying to develop people that they can use as currency more than use on the field in 2 or 3 years, where some of the poorer teams, that's what, you know, that's what they're shooting for.
Well, I
people on the field.
Just as a different sport reference, then we'll let Kevin go. John's younger brother, Pete Najarian. Pete had a nice career at Minnesota. He was all Big Ten. And he was not that big of a guy. I mean, when you say, you know, you look at him, he's not a little guy, but he's not a big guy. But he's real fast. He was a hurdler champ in high school. And he said that it was the getting drafted. If you don't want to be the last person. Where they have 7 rounds now? Was it 7 now, Kevin? So you don't want to be in the last round, especially if you. He says if I could have researched the teams, found a team with a 4 linebacker set like a lot of them play. My position was, is it the inside guy on the weak side that actually covers the backs and stuff? He goes, I could cover a back. He goes, I was never big enough. If you put me on the Bears and put me in the middle, you know, like Butkus and those kind of guys, where their defense calls for you to shed the center. He goes, center's 30 pounds heavier than me. That's not me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a question of you finding the place. Now, Russell, if you're a pretty darn good shortstop, I'm going to say you have the mental capacity of checking everybody's minor league system and saying, wow, looks like the Cubs have 58 outfielders. They only got one shortstop in the minor league system. Maybe I'll sign with those guys as opposed to getting drafted by a team that has 7 of them. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, it's not brain surgery, I don't think. But they don't have it. But otherwise, you get signed by somebody, and like you say, you hope that it becomes, you know, good for them someday to trade you to a team that needs a shortstop for something else. But then, it's in their hands, not yours, which is kind of a bad spot.
Yeah. Hey, just one note, speaking of baseball, the Cubs made a good signing yesterday, I thought, in Justin Turner. He's 40 years old, so he's not as good as he was, you know, in his All-Star years, but that gives him a solid veteran who can play first and third, a decent power, you know, and as a part-time player. I think that's exactly what this team needed. To round out their infield. They have a couple of middle infielders in camp who are, you know, kind of the career backup guys there. So I thought that was a good signing.
Well, if they start signing these old guys, what about us?
What about us?
I was just checking on my IU eligibility.
I got to
sign up for a couple classes in the fall, and I am going to be holding the ball for the dude kicking the field goals.
You know, I kind of thought you would be a candidate for basketball coach there.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious. No. Listen.
I've been reading that they want to go after Michigan's Dusty May. We may kill Joel yet, and we may see him commit, you know, end it all yet.
God. Kevin, thank you very much, bud. SP Futures down 8, NASDAQ Futures down 19. Russell, what's going on in the world? There's all kinds of crazy stuff going in the markets. I've seen some big moves last Friday. There was like a $60 move in the gold during the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still, you know, every time we do a lot of these earnings plays for clients, and they're small plays. We don't gun around a lot of people's money. That's not what we do. We're a protected firm. But one of the it's startling to me how traditionally wrong the market seems to be lately, because on earnings. You know, if you look at the call and the put called the straddle, it's kind of the market's assessment of how much the stock is going to move on earnings. And I'm going to say for the first gazillion years of me in the business, even though you could never do this for a client because you can't be short contracts, well, I don't want to be. Some people do. You could sell the straddle, and I'd say you have a slight chance over if you did a 500 of them of coming out ahead, because not many people can be short the straddle. So say it's a little price too high normally. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to say a little bit, because obviously if it's really priced high, you'd say you don't have an efficient market, which I think we do. But lately, Russell, there's been 2, 3, 4 times straddle moves like every day.
Yeah.
I've never seen that. What is that market fabric that once it moves at night, there's nobody there? Or what is it?
It has to do with...
it really goes back a couple of decades to where we got some change. We got legal changes with respect to the dissemination of information, and companies have to, they can't share any material inside information with anybody, and if they do, they're supposed to share it with everybody. So, and you know, that was kind of an unwritten rule, but now it, you know, it got put into law. It also got put into law that you that the CEO was responsible, legally responsible, for assuring that the results that were put out are accurate and that there's no fraud going on in there. And I think the CFO signs off on that as well. The ones that they can truly get in trouble for are the annual reports, not the quarterly. So we're right now, we're seeing annual reports. And they, I haven't updated it in some time, but a few years ago, I did a whole study about the volatility of earnings on the fourth quarter versus the other three quarters, and it's much greater on the fourth quarter, but the options don't adjust for that. Okay. And so you see this every spring. I feel like we've had this conversation before about this time.
We did, except this year
it truly has to do with the market structure around how that information is shared, and that companies really can't, you know, two or three weeks before earnings, the Goldman Sachs IBM analysts can't check in with IBM and find out that there are, you know, that there are a few issues going on with, you know, that there are a few issues going on there.
Well, I don't believe for a second that nobody gets the info, but still, I mean,
but there are repercussions with people getting the info. Hell, and the reason I brought up Goldman Sachs and IBM is because back in the day, there was, well, it really should have been a different company, but back in the day, the Goldman Sachs analyst was 100% the axe and the person that had all the information that you wanted about a couple of technology companies, and I feel like IBM might have been one of them.
Well, there were
positive or negative comment leading up to earnings announcements, the stocks reacted to a ridiculous extent one way or another.
Well, you're right, but it wasn't just Goldman. All the big firms seemed to have a guy, mostly we're all guys.
Yeah, I mean, it was Smith Barney, it was Microsoft, because Bill Gates had a giant crush on, boy, did we find out what a dog he was. Everybody always thought it was a joke that he would give more information to the Smith Barney analyst because he was attracted to her than other analysts. He would once a quarter have dinner alone with her.
Where would the dinner be?
That's who you listen to on that stock.
We're talking a dinner at a restaurant or dinner in a
room? I don't know, and I don't want to make anything. I do know that they would have that they would meet up about once a quarter to discuss what was going on at Microsoft. There was a rumor that to demonstrate that he wasn't physically weak, that he once jumped over a chair flat-footed in front of her.
That's how you break a leg.
Yeah, that's right. So, I don't know, man. Risk reward. If that had what it had taken to get her retention, then go for it. Women make boys idiots. We all know that.
Well, that's the truth. I seem to recall when I first got to the trading floor, there were only like 120 stacks or something, Russell. And I'm going to say every single one had an analyst that people thought knew that stock better than anybody else. It could have been from Smith Barney, it could have been from Hornblower, it could have been from God knows where. But every stock had like 10 analysts that followed it that you could name the guys back when people used to do that. And there would be a guy at, like you say, Merrill Lynch that followed IBM.
They were kind of the axe in that stock. You don't really have an axe in a stock anymore, and it's because of the rule changes that we saw. But it's also increased the volatility around earnings. The fourth quarter earnings.
But nobody wants to pay for that research. But the idea for the research was, if you fast backward, actually before PTI was even existed, because we started in 90 or 91, that was already kind of getting a little out of favor. But in 1984, in order for PTI to be a really solid firm, we would need five or six guys that had nothing but analyze, say, 15 stocks. What the idea was, when one of those guys became bullish, we would call our clients and say, you know, Russell just turned bullish on, you know, whatever, Merck or something. And we would have 50 clients that would say, well, buy me some Merck. And by the way, when people bought Merck, it was like 5% of the price of the Merck. You know, I mean, if the guy spent $20,000, you might end up with a $1,000 ticket. Well, that once that stopped happening, people saying, well, why am I paying all these guys to give people information when it doesn't get me anywhere? So I think to a large extent, the analyst world is not only shut off information, I don't think they exist. There's not 40 people following Merck like there used to be. Why would you do that? Why would we ever hire a guy to do that, to give people information and turn around and do the money at, you know, someplace else for free? Or what they think
because
is so
you're not, because you're not going to get any investment banking work from Merck unless you have a buy side or have an analyst talking to the buy side about your stuff.
Yeah, there's still some reasons, but it's not.
And I tell, you know, I spoke to a research and trading club of college students last night, and I said, you know, one of my opinions on how to do well in the markets is concentrate on your niche. You found a great niche that you concentrate on and do well with it. And I said, don't start digging into and thinking about trading a stock, or, you know, every stock that you hear about on CNBC. Focus in on your niche and find a good niche to be involved in.
But you know what, Russell, the people who do that, that sell, like, even there's still people now that, you know, have sites where you can buy in and they'll give you stock picks and something. We have a lot of people that trade just totally electronically here through the IB platform.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the reason why they use us is because if there's ever a glitch with, you know, something not working or whatever, instead of sitting on a phone IB for a while, you can call us and we do it a lot quicker. So it's sort of like it's IB with a help desk. You know, and if you really get a position that you walk your way into a five-sided trade, you have no idea how to get out of it, you know, we'll help you, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So people come in, and it's pretty much the same price. So for anybody to not do that, I think is kind of crazy, but that would just be me. But the you do wonder where these, when I say these people, clients of ours, but we don't, you know, they do all their own stuff. They'll do trades every day, and there'll be a stock that, well, where did the guy get that one? You know, it's clearly, there's people still giving advice. There's people who trade the CNBC stuff all day. There's people who trade the Cramer stuff. I mean, why people believe these people, I have no idea. You know, because I tell you what, I've been doing this a long time, and I'm pretty good at it. And if you ask me, buy this stock or sell that stock, that got knocked out of me about my third day on the trading floor. Walking in the morning and go, well, that one's going to be up. You know, that one's going to be down. Good luck with that. I mean, obviously, if all of a sudden there was some massive bad news came out, and, you know, pick a stock, McDonald's or something, you know, they get, people are dying from... If the stock went from, you know, 304 to like 100 or something, you might hear me say, boy, down here it looks like they're still making some money. Maybe it's not a bad, but you're never going to get me to say, gee, run out today and buy McDonald's at 304 because I think it's worth 308. You're going to make $4 in a week. I'll never do that because I know that's idiotic. Yet people do it all the time, right?
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
no.
Just say it. What do you, we talked yesterday with Hal. And regarding, you know, market valuations, I mean, I know you feel the market is, have been for a while, think some of the stocks are pretty highly, you know, highly priced. But Russell, say, I'm trying to get this question together. Then we're going to go to break. Maybe you can think about it during break. How do people even get their arms around the money we're talking about? I mean, when the Chinese AI thing came out, that one Monday morning, or it came out on Sunday, and all of a sudden this thing was going to, you know, take a big punch into AI. Of course, every idiot in the world came out all day long and said, no way on earth, you got to stick with the regular guys. Well, NVIDIA had, I forget what big of a move it was to the downside, and the next day it was pretty much unchanged.
Yeah, that's because everybody figured out the news was kind of BS.
Or... People who own those kinds of stocks jump to their rescue, which you see all constantly. But either way, the swing in value from the bottom to the top, I had clocked at about $600 billion. And I went back, where are we, 2025? I think I went back to 2020. There were only four or five companies that were worth $600 billion. And this was the swing in a company in one day, or 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Just does anybody even have an idea that when you're talking about a company with what Is it 25 billion shares outstanding? When they start moving $10 and $15 back and forth in a day, the kind of cash we're talking about, I mean, is it even remotely? I can't even conceive of that. And yet, nobody seems to, you know, companies worth a couple of trillion dollars. Well, God bless. Do they make any money? No. I mean, I saw the thing about the NBA last week. I don't know if you were on that show, but there's companies, NBA teams, that they're valuing at $6 billion that made $100 million last year. How the hell do you buy anything for $6 billion and made $100 million?
Because you think you're going to be able to sell it to somebody for $700?
Well, without a doubt. But what I'm saying, it is kind of bizarre how if you were teaching one of your classes to say, oh, yeah, this is worth $6 billion. I mean, I don't know. S&P futures down 12, NASDAQ futures down 38. Short break, be right back, Professor Russell. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 12. NASDAQ futures down 36. We were up a little last night. Then we were down. Then we came back to even. And now we're down a little bit again, but only a little bit. And last night, we're kind of giving back what we ran up on the close. Must be a lot of mutual fund buying right now because we ran up like in the last 5 minutes. We're down a little bit, just a little bit, like most of the day. Over in Asia, we have the Asia-Pacific markets trade mixed. Is Trump proposes tariffs on autos, semiconductors, and pharma goods. There you go. Nikkei down 105.3%. Hang Seng down 32. These guys are up a bunch, yesterday. Down 0.1%. Shanghai up 27.8. So that's a real number for those guys. They're back up to 33.51. So stock's been pretty buoyant lately. European markets. We've got the DAX down 252. That's 1.1%. Europe stocks fall as earnings disappoint. Philips down 11%. So there you go. Puts you down 57.7, CAC round down 64.8. Bonds up 3 basis points. And these things were up a bunch yesterday. They were creeping again to the upside. Kind of surprised the market came back yesterday because there was a full 1% move in the bonds. But the bond up 6 basis points, 2.55. So we're back up to 4.58 on the 10-year, and in the 30-year, we're 4.8 exactly, pretty much. So we're creeping again. Oil. Up 70 cents, 72.55. Brent up 63 cents, 76.47. Natural gas up 21 cents, 4.22. Does that mean it's going to stay colder longer? Andrew, what's going on with natural gas? Rar Bob up a penny, 2.10. Gold up 6.70, 29.55. Silver up 8 cents, 33.45. Copper unchanged, 4.58. Foreign exchange, $1 104 to the euro and 126 to the pound, so kind of right where it's been. Crypto. Up $2,200, 96,300. Well, still kind of sort of violent in the middle, 90,000s, that's a word. Andrew, we got for us Traffic Weather Sports.
All right, it is 7:35 here in Chicago. And correct me if I'm wrong, but looks like not very much in the terms of, in the world of sports here.
It's one game tonight. In the NBA, it's the canceled game from the fire, the Lakers and somebody.
Yep. That's rescheduled from January 9th, it's saying here. Hornets against the Lakers. And then tomorrow, in terms of our quote-unquote favorite teams, tomorrow night we can look forward to a game of the Bulls But over to Chicago, weather is currently 6 degrees right now. It's going to be cloudy and bitterly cold. A flurry late this afternoon. We're going to have a high of 17 throughout the day. Over in Phoenix, they're doing a lot better. They're at 49 degrees. They're going to have a nice day with intervals of cloud and sunshine. And they're going to have a high of 79. And finally, for Chicago traffic, looks like no major accidents to report. Just some heavy traffic on the inbound expressways. And if you're on the outbound, look out if you're heading towards the west or the north. As again, no accidents to report, but traffic is overall looking pretty heavy. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, we had a interesting, well, kind of what I was talking about before the break. We had an interesting conversation with Kenny yesterday, and he was saying how probably a pullback of 3 or 4 or 5% would be, you know, could be healthy in a buying opportunity and everything. You know, Kenny knows his stuff, so I'm not. Now, you said, okay, when something like that happens, if you think things are, you know, somewhat overvalued, or maybe we've had a nice run-up, which we have, how does somebody essentially have the balls to get on national TV and say, well, we're going to get a pullback, but, at 5%, that's the number, and you can start buying there? Because I remember standing in a pit one day a long time ago where the market was down like 10 or 12% over 3 days, and I said, well, that's probably far enough. Except the next day it went down 22%, and and I seem to recall in 2000, everybody thought the dot-bomb stuff was a little high. Maybe 10% correction was warranted, and went down like 80%. So once you start, calling that kind of stuff, how do you? Now, granted, I think the world is different in a large extent from the actions of Washington. And if we go down 2-3 days in a row, there's no doubt in my mind the Fed will be pouring money into the system, which brings up inflation problems. Are you somewhat, even with the big move, well, relatively big move up in the 10-year and 30-year rates yesterday, are you somewhat surprised that with the two horrible CPI numbers and CPI wasn't as bad last week, that somehow or another interest rates are actually lower than when those numbers came out, or let's say even?
We were anticipating, just a couple of cuts over the course of this year, and a bottoming of rates above 4. That farther out, that number's come down to about 3.75 on this cycle. So I think that longer term implied rate has worked its way back into, because they're all a function of each other, that it's worked its way back into interest rates on longer dated securities, and the rates had gotten ahead of themselves a bit to the upside. So I think that's why I think that's why you've seen what you've seen with the longer dated rates relative to the news that we've seen come out.
Well, back in my day, the inflation rate was not this. Not that I'm going to give an opinion here, this half-assed 2.6, 2.9 trailing year rate. The interest rate was, what was it last month times 12, or the last 2 months together times 6. It wasn't. It was a much more current number. Everybody is talking about last month's number, which actually was, the unadjusted was 0.7 and the adjusted was 0.5. And again, you and I have talked about these monthly adjustments. I don't know where they come from, but 0.5 to me is 6% inflation. And unless there's something percolating that I don't know about, that are actively attacking that number by lowering money supply or doing something else, I don't see that happening anywhere. So why people are saying that the number is really 3, and sort of pricing the 30-year rate off the 3 by saying it's okay, let's say it's 5, which gives you a implied interest or implied real interest rate of 2, which is low. And an implied inflation going forward is 3 equals the 5. Well, I don't see either one of those estimates anywhere near where I think they're going to be. We still seem to be feeding people all this stuff like this is inevitably coming down. I talked to 3-4 people in the last few days, are absolutely convinced that the change in Washington is going to cause inflation to go down. Everything that I see, certainly in the automotive.
I don't agree with that. In fact, I think I even think Trump said that over the short term there might be some pain around some things that he's doing.
He's talking tariffs. I'm talking about what's already going on, not even the tariffs.
Okay. I thought you meant the tariff thing, because the tariff thing can cause some big disconnects. There's no question on that one.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that we're sort of, I don't know what the market is doing, pricing things what they are. I mean, I don't fight it at all, because that's crazy. Mm-hmm. You can't. I mean, you can fight the market for 2-3 years, and the day you're right, you're broke, right? You can't be doing that. Mm-hmm. But it just seems like something's a little weird here to me. I mean, I see my people in the family had an accident car, so looking for a used car, and I don't, tell you what, she didn't get anywhere near the number for the car that somebody totaled that she can buy even the same car in the used car market. I'm going to say in the last 6 months, just the stuff I'm looking at, used car prices got to be up 8-10% in the last 6 months.
Yeah, something happened where we saw a bump in used cars prices were, like, over the last 2 or 3 months, were way ahead of a lot of other metrics, and I couldn't come up with a good reason behind that.
Well, give this assignment out.
I can come up with a reason. You know, there are part shortages for new cars. There's a shortage of used cars coming in. You know, something along those lines. But for life of me, can't figure it out right now.
I would give that assignment out to your class. If I was in your class, I think I would probably come up with an A paper, the ego that I have. I'm going to say, if you look at some sort of a chart over how many people can afford a new car versus at what percentage of the population, that the demand for something other than that, because new cars are in the 40,000-50,000 range, and when you come into a winter, when all of a sudden the real old cars become clunkers and you can't really...
You think there's a little bit where you think that my wife is justified in worrying about me driving back and forth to Indiana when it's 1 degree outside?
Well, I'm just saying, your repair goes up.
If I had a real clunker, I'd have to buy a newer clunker.
Well, the amount of salt in the city, the amount of potholes, and how
she's
many...
She's looking at me nodding yes over and over again. I have to replace my current clunker this afternoon.
How many cars you think were destroyed in California?
Oh, goodness gracious.
I mean,
they do burst into flames, and oh my goodness gracious! Do you know how well? You know how nicely a Tesla burns?
Oh, don't get me started.
And what I mean by that is electric cars are. You don't want to be around an electric car if it catches on fire.
No, well, you don't want me.
I wonder if electric cars in California made that situation worse.
How come?
Nobody would ever say it out loud, but
how come our creatures in government are finding all kinds of alleged fraud and things they don't want to spend money on, that there's no thought of finding a way to have people who own Teslas pay their highway use tax like everybody else does?
I don't know. Have you seen who's standing in the Oval Office with his kid picking his nose next to the president?
You think there's a connection?
It might be. Can't hurt.
But I'm saying, if you were to do a research on the industry, at what percent, if everything's in, quote, equilibrium, what percentage of the population buys a new car every year, which keeps the trade-ins, keeps the used car flow moving? I'm going to say we've been below that number for probably 6-7 years. I mean, what's the average car on the road now? It's 12 years old or something?
There's a lot of them. You know, I don't know why, but I always love it when I see somebody with a dealer tag on their car. I'm like, they got to be really happy because they just bought themselves a new car. You know, it just, they probably, there's a good feeling that goes along with that one. And I don't think, I saw a handful of them yesterday. I saw something really cool on the way down to Indiana that I want to share with you as well. But they tend to not be brand new cars with those tags on them.
Oh, right. And it might
I have noticed that. I said that's a new car to them when I was talking to Dr. Ademiak that rides down with me.
What do you mean? It's new to me.
It's new to them. You know, I just kind of passed somebody. I said, well, their car's new to them. So, I don't know. You know, what's the average age of a car in the U.S.? You know, we went through a time period when I was growing up where cars only lasted about 4 years and they fell apart.
Yeah, but they were three. They were three grand.
That's gotten much, much, much better. You know,
but they were $3,000 too.
Yeah, they were. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The average age of a car in the U.S. right now is 12.6 years.
Yeah. Well, maybe I will dig back. I don't think.
I'm doing it right now, man.
You can't read receipts. I think in my my building, the water heater's gone out, right? I'm going to say a new water heater right now, that size, it's going to cost a minimum of $2,000 because it's vented out. It's a 75-gallon. And it's 16 years old. I will bet you 16 years ago it was $400. And there's no way that the CPI is going to be five times higher in 16 years. No way.
No, absolutely not.
So we're talking about... But anyway, how do you... When you talk about maybe a market correction, how do you limit it to 5% or 6%? Maybe there won't be any. I mean, I honestly think that there's a chance we could maybe grow into this. But, you know, now we're...
If we grow into it, it's going to take some time.
Yeah.
It's going to take... And when I say time, I'm not talking about this summer. I'm talking 3 to 5 years. And so,
yeah.
One of two things is going to happen. We're either going to grow into it, and stocks are going to kind of screw around, or we're going to, you know, the stocks are going to become more fairly valued. And I think I'm leaning toward number two on that one. And yeah, I'm just leaning toward number two on that one. I feel like that we'll get, you know, we'll the economy will continue to grow, et cetera, but we will we most definitely will get better prices.
Well, if these guys.
You mentioned the valuation thing. You know, I looked at the forward price earnings ratio, and when we finished a year where we just finished it, I think we've never had a 5-year period that was up, that we had some sort of correction that we had to overcome within there. And you know, that's what I'm waiting around for.
Well,
that's what you do, and you guard against.
Why is there? I've never seen an orchestrated move by several companies. That's why, you know, you start talking politics and this guy, that guy, and he's doing this and that. I think it's such a load of crap on both sides that I can't even. It's really interesting, Russell, because I'm officially, absolutely in the middle on the politics, and I see both sides can't say a word of truth if their life depended on it, and yet. Yeah. There's people on the right that take everything these guys say as gospel. There's people on the left that take everything, you know, the other way. And I'm like, dudes and ladies, what are you talking about? I mean, just sort of the simple math. I mean, I was listening to Trump yesterday, and like firing people in Washington, you're going to save billions and billions of dollars. Guys, get out your calculator. If we fire 10,000 people, what is that, and what percentage of that is the? Is it the GDP in the government spending? It's, I mean, what are we doing? Is there waste in government? Absolutely, there's waste in government. There always has been.
Yeah, there's waste in everything.
And
yeah.
You know, it's.
But you know, the big difference is, you know, if there's waste at a company, at some point there is some sort of accountability. Whereas in government, there just really hasn't been. You know, instead of calling it the Department of Government Efficiency because, you know, They wanted to match it up with some stupid crypto thing. They really should call it government accountability.
Well, I did some half-assed, and you're probably the most even-tempered dude that I could talk about this with on the show. I did some half-assed calculations a while ago, and I can't find the piece of paper, of course. But there was every year there's a pretty good estimate from the General Accounting Office, whoever the hell it is, about how much in government's wasted. I say wasted, you know, and during the Bush administration, this is, you know, some of it's fraud, you know, false Medicare applications, those kinds of things. Some of it's just maybe sending out a Social Security check 2 months after somebody's dead, that sort of thing, and having somebody still cash it. Anyway, the estimate during the Bush administration was like $90-some billion. And at the end of Bush's term, you know, and he was supposed to be Mr. Whatever, government efficiency, was actually higher. It was like $100 billion or something. But if you divide that, you know, the amount of government spending, it was roughly 3%. Now, that's too high. I don't think You know, Solomon could get it under 1% unless he spent 40 hours a day on it. Now you look at it, the numbers that the Trump administration has thrown around in the General Accounting Office, it's a little more than 3%. And I think some of that had to do in the last few years with a lot of the money that I actually do think was frauded out on COVID. So the COVID bumped that number up a little bit. But basically, it's...
Oh, it's much more. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I had a college student that started an LLC, said he was a consulting firm that was getting hurt by COVID and put in for COVID funds.
Yeah, I you know,
he's actually in jail for something else now. But
you know what?
He did that.
Again. A college student. I know a couple of attorneys that are defending some people who had COVID relation, you know, deal. And now I would say that if you look at where the waste is, not necessarily the fraud, and there is a difference. There's a huge difference. Fraud is a criminal, but there's companies that never missed a paycheck and got like $5 million. I'm talking about garbage companies and people like, there's law firms that,
yeah,
I mean, there's, and the progression was you got to apply for COVID funding, and I'm going to say it was helicopter money. The government just wanted money out there. They didn't care who the hell they gave it to.
Well, everybody was angry about so many different things, that you throw a bunch of money at them so they're not angry about not being able to pay their bills.
Right, so you throw the money at them. The thing was...
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that we did right around COVID.
I don't think it was either.
Period. I mean, for the economy, for people, for our kids, you know, keeping them socially, you know, isolated for as long as we did. And here's the really bad thing about it. I don't think we learned a damn thing from it. You know, typically, you know, I was talking earlier about how earnings announcements are more volatile in the fourth quarter now because we changed some laws. I don't think we learned a damn thing from COVID.
Did you have?
I think, you know, and you keep hearing rumors of these nasty viruses developing in Asia. I don't think our response would be any better. We'd probably err to the other side, and 15 million people would die.
Did you happen to catch the spot on CNBC? God, it was, I think it was on CNBC. Somewhere during the, I was after. Anyway, there's older lady on there, and, you know, she wasn't 90 or anything, but she was essentially the holder of, I think during the Eisenhower administration, Ike or somebody around him said, we should develop a plan in case there's ever maybe it was even before that, in case there's ever a big pandemic and how we're going to handle it. So guys, ladies, spent time and put this thing together, and it was about, I'm going to say it was 1,000 pages or so. It was, you know, you could hold it, but it was heavy. And she said every administration that's come in after that has essentially updated the plan, even though, you know, it's pretty much the same as Plan A. It's, you know, it's been updated with the different medicines and the different stuff. She goes, when this happened, nobody ever looked at any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that's pretty ignorant to have a plan and not even look at it. It's like, yeah, it's like we have the Simpson or the Simpson Bowles thing. Do you think these guys are even looking at that?
No.
I mean, why would you look at something like that? A full study and everything. So and I think we had an issue with, you know, the money, but some of the illogic stuff. I mean, on a personal level, I actually had a test in a hospital and caught COVID because I had a procedure they were going to do, and all of a sudden we couldn't do it because, hey, buddy, you got COVID. Well, 10 days later, I went to my doctor and I got the test for the antibodies. And sure enough, they're blinking away because I didn't even feel bad, so I wasn't sure I had it. But sure enough, I had. And now, everybody, I think anybody would probably agree in this world that after that, I was no danger to anybody. Yet I couldn't go to work. I couldn't go out. I could have been one of the guys who I would have done this, by the way. I would have volunteered to serve dinners at a nursing home. I was no danger to anybody.
No.
Yet I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't go wander around without a mask, which is ignorant. What did I need a mask for? Because so other people... we did everything stupid. We closed down all these stores, and so, you know, Russell's Blue Jeans store, he had to close. He had to cross the street. The Walmart selling blue jeans, and they were okay. I mean, everything. I could see us doing it for a week or two.
The whole thing was a mess.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything that we did right around COVID.
Hey,
you know, we let them put chemicals in our body that didn't fix a damn thing. Sure didn't, you know, did not stop the spread of it.
No.
You know, just made you not feel as bad if you had it.
Well, you should have made sure we got that to all the older people, which we didn't.
And a majority of people should have known that they had it instead of covering over the, instead of covering up the symptoms so that maybe they knew not to go out for 2 or 3 days.
What do you make of, we don't have a few minutes here, but
the whole thing was just, my opinion of our healthcare industry just continues to just go down and down and down.
I have a lot of friends that have been ill lately, and I see what's happening in these hospitals, and I'm stunned.
I recently had a workup where they said basically I had no concussion symptoms, period, at all from the thing that happened to me a couple of years, which was absolute crap. You know, they said I'm basically depressed. Not that I have anything to do with it. Like, are you kidding me? What the hell do I have to be depressed about? I got the hottest wife in the world.
You got two wonderful daughters. You're on Stacks and Jacks.
Two great dogs. One of them's looking at me whining and crap. I think somebody's getting ready to give me a kiss. Thanks, Daisy. The dog gave me a kiss on the face as I said that.
Speaking of dogs, we almost had a issue in the family. Injury.
No, I don't want to hear dog issues.
Well, almost. Because Maggie, the crazy little Maltese, mm-hmm. I let her out. All of a sudden, Audrey hears her bark and she's screaming. And I go flying out the back door and we let the poodle out. Well, there's a coyote on the other side of the fence, and Maggie's gonna kick ass on the coyote. She's 18 years old. She's about 6 pounds.
You
got two. So I talked to one of my friends who's in the medical, the vet tech community. She goes, "Yeah, we've got a lot of coyote bites." She goes, "In almost every instance, it's the dog attacking the coyote. Some stupid little dog."
Oh yeah, No, we lived in rural. We backed up to nothing for a couple of miles in Kansas for a little less than a year, and my little terrier, man, he would go after, we would have all kinds of stuff. We'd have coyotes, foxes, deer, everything, and that dog was protecting our 2 acres, no question about it.
When a terrier looks in the mirror, what do you think they see? Some Rottweiler?
A lion.
Yeah, that's awesome.
A lion.
I got a question for you. The Trump administration, for the first time, and boy, you know, like I said, a lot of what those guys are doing, I think, you know, it makes some sense. They're letting out all these files on the Kennedy RFK and all that stuff, and evidently, I'm not sure exactly how, I mean, right now, is it the people in Congress can read them all? Somewhere, someplace, they're in the process of being let out to the public. Now, I don't know if they're redacted, not redacted, they've kind of been light on the details.
Yeah, they also found a lot of documents that hadn't been reviewed yet, so there will be some time behind this.
Well, some lady, I mean, a female.
That's her job. I think she's kind of in charge of checking them out.
She's very dark-haired, fairly attractive. Yeah. She came out and she said, "I've been looking at this stuff. It's obvious to me there were at least two shooters, or there were two shooters."
I heard her saying that there was definitely, that there definitely, everything that she read so far, she's believing that, you know, there's definitely a second shooter in there somewhere.
We did a lot of research on that when I was in college, but I didn't realize a lot of people thought there was a second shooter for RFK. Did you?
No, I've never heard that before. I mean, if you see the video of the RFK one thing, kind of haunted me because that happened when I was, you know, like between 5 and 10. I was young. So, you know, it's a little kid thing, kind of freaks you out when you see on TV somebody, and again, we weren't subjected to the kind of violence in media that we are now. So that was kind of shocking, you know, when somebody just walked up and shot somebody like that. I don't see how you could have had a second shooter on that one. There might have been a second person there that wanted to kill him, but I don't think that was a coordinated
effort. The dude who just got approved as our health secretary, RFK Jr., is absolutely convinced there were two people. And has been for 2 decades. I mean, he could very well be right. I mean, obviously he knows more about it than I do, but it does seem somewhat...
Go get the... You know what? He's probably in a position now where he can find out for sure.
Well, evidently, in sequential order, opening up Kennedy, RFK, MLK, 9/11, which I think is going to be amazingly interesting, and then also the origin of the COVID thing. And I remember at the time, Russell, I think you and I were talking about it. It's what was the God, this is going to sound so stupid. The disease before COVID that got out and was
bird flu?
No, it was something that came out of
not Ebola, but Ebola always scares us.
Oh yeah, but this was it came out of, I think it was the Bat Cave somewhere. It took like three.
That's Ebola.
No, Ebola is the bleeding disease. This was a flu, yeah, kind of thing. Might have been SARS or H1N, whatever those one okay. of those two. And it seemed to me that when we our people, the people we're all firing, I think a lot of these people actually know what they're doing. And that mm-hmm. particular one, it didn't take more than, I'm going to say, it wasn't even a month before they said
SARS.
Yeah, where they said it came from bats, but it came through camels. They were able to trace the thing from where it was to humans through. And when they started talking about that wet market in Wuhan, and they were working on that for a week and didn't find anything in there, I'm going, wait a minute. If these guys can't find it, this had to come from somewhere else. I mean, that was my suspicion right out of the gate. Go ahead.
If somebody makes a gigantic technology breakthrough invention and it comes from the United States, where do you think that most likely, you have to guess where it most likely came from? Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
Wuhan is the center for basically biological research in China. That's what they're known for.
And they're funded by other people.
It's already very suspect that it started in that place. But I mean, it's kind of the same thing. There's just automatic logic that even if it happened to if somebody got it in the wet market, it probably escaped from the lab somewhere.
I used to get a lot of stuff that we'd report on the show that really didn't get anywhere else out, and it wasn't because you and I were doing it, but we actually have some listeners in London and in Britain and on the continent. I don't know how they found us, but we have some people.
I'm international.
Yeah, could be you. But
I won't be here next week because I'm doing a whole thing in London and then a whole thing in Frankfurt. Right, I'm taking credit for all the international audience.
Well, good. But so, okay. One guy sent me a study from God knows where. This is about a year or 8 months into it. And they said that a lot of these things, the reason how they can attach to your cells is because they have it's a scratch protein. You know what I'm talking about? The thing has a little bit like a zit on it almost, that's how it attaches to your cells.
Yeah, it's and that's why they show us the picture of it that kind of looks like something looks like one of those things that you'd get stuck on the bottom of your jeans when you went playing in the woods as a kid.
And well,
it's the virus equivalent of that.
Well, but they said this study showed that these things had two.
Mm-hmm.
What made them so contagious, and it said there's no way on earth that there's a natural occurring one like that. It had to have been done in a lab.
Yeah, you basically that's weaponizing the virus.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Anyway.
All right, I want to give a shout out because I know we're bumping up against the time. And I want to find out who's responsible for this, and I want to make that. I want to put them in as head of the Department of Transportation. So I get up I get to sleep in when I do your show. I get up at 3:45 to go down to Indiana on Tuesday and Thursday to teach, and another professor rides along with me. And yesterday, going down 65, going faster than the average traffic, we passed a caravan of 25 snowplows with Minnesota plates. All those snowplows are in Nashville today, making sure everybody can get to work, etc.
Really?
Cities in Tennessee, when I grew up in Memphis, which is not Nashville, but one of the things that they do share is the inability to deal with the weather. You'd get a half inch of snow in Memphis and we wouldn't go to school, because we didn't have any way to remove it at all. Whoever figured out that they could borrow all of those snowplows, because I looked at the national paper this morning,
because I knew they were going to have weather, and I saw a picture of a snowplow with Minnesota plates on it. God, now, talk about a great use of, you know, resources. Call up all the northern cities, find one that's not planning on seeing any snow for the next 4 or 5 days, and borrow all their snowplows.
What do you
think? Well, I mean, there you go. I mean, that logic in government.
What? How much? How miserable is a ride that long in a snowplow with the blade in the front? Good Lord.
I will guarantee you that they were getting paid per hour.
Probably.
For the whole time that they, from when they got in, the guys driving it, that they basically were getting paid from the second they turned the engine on in Minnesota to, you know, when they get back.
Don't take this personally,
but... I don't care how miserable it is. I will bet you that is a great bonus for a lot of guys that work in that capacity.
Well, don't take this personally, but I could see why people from your state might be screwed up. Just saying.
Hey, no.
The idea of having snow on the ground where you can't go to school, yet the snow isn't deep enough to play in, that's weird.
Yeah, well, it really is. There's no ability to remove it from the streets. But also, when you got snow in Memphis, it's typically, you know, typically the temperature's in the 20s, and that is very conducive to ice.
Yeah. And I assume these snow plows are also...
Nobody, I don't care, you know, how experienced you are, nobody can drive on ice.
I assume that these snow plow trucks were also salt trucks.
Yeah, they were. It was a whole caravan of... You know, I'm driving along, and after passing, you know, 10 of them in a row, I'm like, what? Where are these plates from? And
now, does Nashville have salt down there to refill them, or no?
I honestly do not know. I was kind of scanning through the article about it just as I was coming on, and they said that you know, they've got a real focus on the Central Business District, and they were putting salt down. Now, I don't know where they got it from.
Because
they were putting it down.
If they have to buy it in season, it's a fortune. It's a fortune.
You know what? They may have bought it from a northern state. Yeah. That might be a great way that Illinois could make some money.
If you got 30 seconds,
turn around and sell it to the southern states that are getting more and more. You know, they're seeing more and more winter type weather because of the climate change.
If you have 30 seconds before we go, I'll give you a quick story about. I think you know me well enough to know that I pretty much like everybody. I very seldom, and I find people in the trading floor that I didn't like so much because they were kind of greedy, but most of the time, I get along with everybody, right? And so, So Audrey has a good friend of hers, and she ended up marrying this guy. He was older. It's a long, long time ago. So we go out to dinner with him, and the dude is a chairman of some big company that happens to sell salt, right? And the night is miserable. I've got my old Toyota four-wheel drive, so we get there okay. And the guy sits down, and he is happier than a clam in crap, basically. And because there were so many accidents that night that he thought Chicago was going to have to up their salt order. And he was, and I go, wait a minute, you're happy because people are banging into each other? Yeah, I get to sell a lot more salt. I'm like, what am I doing here with this guy?
that's exactly the kind of corporate greed that shows up in movies.
I'm like, you know, what am I doing here? And I couldn't. Plus, we went to get a little, this is even a dumber story. It's back when he was still playing handball and stuff, could eat a lot. And Audrey is, you know, Audrey exercised a lot. She's got a big appetite. So we're done at this French place. And I think this is how many long ago? It cost me a couple hundred bucks. And I didn't want to say anything when we left. Because, you know, this is back when you're trying to be nice. Audrey goes, by the way, you must still be hungry. And I go, well, yeah, a little bit. She goes, I'm starving. They didn't give us any food, just the bill. what do you say we stop at the White Castle? So it cost me $200. This has got to be 20 years ago, maybe more. And this is probably in the 90s. It cost me $200 for dinner. We had to go to White Castle on the way home in a snowstorm. How was that for an evening?
It's a story. It gave you a story.
Anyway, you be safe. You're not here next week. We'll get a sub, and maybe next week we'll. Maybe you can trade some time because I have no problem with you on a couple times. So whatever, we'll talk. But be safe. Don't be on the plane that like flips over like the one in Detroit.
If I do, I will share a cool video about it.
Oh God! S&P futures down down 8, NASDAQ futures down 14. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.